From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The Bush administration, despite strongly criticizing the government of Sudan, accused the regime of genocide in Darfur, it listed the country as a state sponsor of terrorism. But despite all that, it has a very close intelligence sharing arrangement with the Sudanese Mukhabarat, its CIA.
The Bush administration allies itself with the Sudan despite its role in the genocide in Darfur. We'll speak with Ken Silverstein, the reporter who broke the story in the Los Angeles Times, as well as a New Jersey Congress member. Then, it's been 60 years since the dawn of the nuclear age, 30 years since the end of the Vietnam War. Today, we'll talk to Daniel Ellsberg, the war's chief whistleblower, about another.
35 years ago, the Non-Proliferation Treaty went into effect. From the point of view of the United States, it was a hoax from the beginning. Israel was understood to be a nuclear power at that time, and we not only tolerated that, we encouraged it. Mordecai Vanunu is facing prison again for unveiling that hoax.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, another 24 people died on Monday as the Iraqi resistance launched another wave of attacks. Since Friday, more than 140 Iraqis have been killed. Meanwhile, the U.S. is searching for the remains of two Navy F-18 pilots. It appears a pair of U.S. planes collided over southern Iraq on Monday. In Washington, the military's highest-ranking officer is warning that the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are limiting the Pentagon's ability to deal with other armed conflicts. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Richard Myers told Congress in a classified report that should the U.S. stage any other attacks, the operations would end up being more protracted and produce higher U.S. casualties because of the commitment of Pentagon sources in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Army also announced Monday that it has fallen short of its recruiting goals for the third month in a row. The Army is on pace to fall 15% short of its annual recruiting target. Meanwhile, in Colorado, military recruiters are coming under criticism after a high school student exposed that recruiters were urging students to lie about their past in order to qualify for the military. The student journalist posed as a high school dropout with a drug problem who wanted to enlist. The recruiters essentially said no problem and went on to tell him how to create a fabricated high school diploma and how to cheat on his drug test. The student recorded the interactions, and part of the video aired Monday on CBS News. The Army has suspended the two recruiters involved. Also Monday, the Supreme Court announced it will take up the issue of military recruiting on college campuses. The court will hear arguments in the fall on whether Congress withheld federal money from universities that bar recruiters. Many schools have tried to bar recruiters to protest the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. At the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan urged the United States and Russia to reduce their nuclear arsenals. Annan's call came during the opening day of a month-long review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Annan said, quote, "Ultimately, the only way to guarantee they will never be used is for our world to be free of such weapons. Under the 35-year-old treaty, the world's non-nuclear countries have pledged not to pursue nuclear arms in exchange for a commitment from the U.S., Russia, Britain, France, and China to move toward nuclear disarmament. Three other nuclear states, Israel, India, and Pakistan, remain outside the treaty. On Monday, the nuclear countries were criticized for not moving fast enough toward disarmament. Meanwhile, the U.S. and other nations called on Iran and North Korea to give up and dismantle their nuclear programs. On Capitol Hill, congressional negotiators agreed Monday to measures that would discourage states from issuing driver's licenses to undocumented workers and make it harder for asylum seekers to gain entry into the country. According to the Los Angeles Times, the driver's license provision would for the first time set national standards for the state-issued documents. The key standard would require every applicant for a driver's license to prove legal residency in the United States. If a state opted not to comply, its driver's licenses, even those issued to citizens and legal residents, would not be recognized as valid for federal identification purposes, such as boarding an airplane or opening a bank account. In Italy, investigators have published a report on the shooting of a secret agent in Iraq by U.S. troops that conflicts with the Pentagon's version of events. The Italian report blames the troops' stress and inexperience. It also charges U.S. authorities should have signaled there was a checkpoint on the road. Intelligence officer Nicola Calipari died in the March 4th shooting, and journalist Giuliana Segrena was injured. Officials in New Jersey have posted a $1 million reward for the capture of former Black Panther Assata Shakur. In 1977, Shakur was convicted in the killing of a New Jersey police officer during a shootout that left one of her fellow activists dead. She was shot twice by police during the incident. In 1979, Assata Shakur, who was born Joanne Chesimard, managed to escape from jail. She fled to Cuba, where she received political asylum. She once wrote, quote, "I am a 20th century escaped slave. Because of government persecution, I was left with no other choice than to flee from the political repression, racism, and violence that dominate the U.S. government's policy towards people of color." On Monday, the 32nd anniversary of the shooting, New Jersey officials announced the $1 million bounty. It's the largest reward ever placed on an individual in the state. In addition, the FBI placed her name on a watch list of domestic terrorists. In recent years, numerous hip-hop stars, including Public Enemy and Common, have publicly supported Shakur. Her godson was the late Tupac Shakur. In Haiti, the country's former prime minister, Yvan Neptune, has refused to leave the country to go into exile in the Dominican Republic. Neptune said he will not leave unless he's given unconditional release from house arrest. Neptune served as prime minister under the ousted president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He's been in the jail for the past 10 months. Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan joined with Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton Monday to announce a major rally in Washington to mark the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March. They're calling it the Millions More Movement. Farrakhan said, quote, "Millions more means we're reaching for the millions who carry the rich on their backs." Organizers are promoting a day of absence from work and school on Friday, October 14th, followed by a march in Washington on the 15th and religious services the next day. The family of an award-winning British filmmaker who was shot dead by the Israeli army announced Monday it's suing the Israeli government. Israeli soldiers shot and killed James Miller on May 2, 2003. He was 34 years old. The city of Boston has agreed to pay out over $5 million to the family of a college student who died after police shot her with a pepper spray pellet. The incident occurred as police were trying to control a crowd of celebrating baseball fans last October. Victoria Snellgrove was a 21-year-old student at Emerson College. And Bob Hunter, one of the founders of Greenpeace, has died at the age of 62. The Guardian of London described Hunt as the most influential of the group's early leaders. In 1969, he first made headlines when he sailed to the Aleutian Islands off Alaska to try to stop the U.S. testing of a nuclear bomb. He was the first president of Greenpeace, came up with the name Rainbow Warrior for the group's flagship, and in 1979, he officially founded Greenpeace International.
To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to be. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, A time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.
Turn, Turn, Turn by Pete Seeger. Today is his 86th birthday. Happy birthday, Pete. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the days after the September 11th attacks, President Bush issued an ultimatum to the world. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. 4.5 years later, it's been revealed the Bush administration has allied itself with a government listed as a state sponsor of terrorism and one that the administration has accused of committing genocide against its own people, Sudan. A major exposé in the Los Angeles Times Friday revealed that the U.S. has quietly forged a close intelligence partnership with Sudan despite the government's role in the mass killings in Darfur. The Sudanese government has since publicly confirmed it's working with the Bush administration and the CIA. 8 months ago, former Secretary of State General Colin Powell accused Sudan of carrying out a genocide in Darfur. Already 180,000 have died in the region from fighting or hunger. But relations appear to have since changed for the better for Sudan. One senior Sudanese official, the Los Angeles Times reports that the country had achieved complete normalization of relations with the CIA. The Times reports the CIA sent an executive jet last week to Khartoum to ferry the chief of Sudan's intelligence agency to Washington for secret meetings, sealing Khartoum's sensitive and previously veiled partnership with the administration. The Sudanese intelligence chief, Major General Salah Abdallah Gash, has been accused by members of Congress of directing military attacks against the civilians in Darfur. He also had regular contacts with Osama bin Laden during the 90s. Last month, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice sent a letter to the Sudanese government calling for steps to end the conflict in Darfur. But the letter, reviewed by the Los Angeles Times, also said the administration hoped to establish a, quote, fruitful relationship with Sudan and look forward to, quote, continued close cooperation on terrorism. We're joined in our Washington studio by Ken Silverstein, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who broke the story. And we welcome you, Ken, to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you lay out for us exactly what you've learned about the U.S.-Sudan relationship?
Well, the relationship really started even pre-9/11. In July of 2001, former Assistant Secretary of State Walter Kanzinger traveled to Nairobi, where he had a public meeting with the rebel leader John Garang, and then privately met with the Sudanese foreign minister. Then approximately the following month, there was a secret meeting in London with Yahya Hussein Babacar, who at the time was the deputy chief of Sudanese intelligence, at which the topic of cooperation on counterterrorism was broached. But the relationship really took off post 9/11. For both sides had pragmatic reasons, and I think that's really at the heart of this. The U.S., after 9/11, wanted to obtain information on al-Qaeda and Islamic extremists from whenever and wherever it could, and it decided that it would cooperate with any regime that was willing to provide that information, including Sudan. For the Sudanese, there was fear that after Afghanistan, they might be next on the list of U.S. targets for military action, and so both sides had grounds to cooperate. By November of 2001, the collaboration was very strong. I spoke to a former FBI agent who traveled to Khartoum in November of 2001. At the time, the CIA had an active station, which it had been shut down. Their last station had been shut down in late 1995. By November of 2001, they had a very active station. They were tracking Islamic extremists with the cooperation of the Mukhabarat, which is the Sudanese equivalent of the CIA. The FBI agent actually had gone to Khartoum to interview longtime members of al-Qaeda who had very close ties to Osama bin Laden. The Mukhabarat made these suspects available to the FBI. They arranged safe houses for the interviews to be conducted. the FBI agent went to the Al-Shamal Bank, where bin Laden had multiple business accounts when he lived in Sudan between 1991 and 1996. They turned over all the banking records. And, you know, that really kicked off the relationship, which has deepened ever since.
Now, you talk to Ghosh?
I was able to interview him, and he simply confirmed that the Mukhabarat had a ongoing close partnership with the CIA. There was, you know, he was very open about that. I also spoke to a number of former top officials at the Mukhabarat who are still, two of them in particular, who are among the most powerful men in the country. They both had offices at the presidential palace in Khartoum, and they were very open about the relationship. They said, one of them said that we have a completely normalized our relationships with the CIA. He said the CIA was helping to try to smooth the broader political relationship between Sudan and the Bush administration. They were open about the relationship. I think, in fact, that they feel that they want... I think that to a certain extent they cooperated with me and allowed me access because they feel that they want recognition for some of their efforts that they feel have not been noted, and they want rewards. I mean, there's no question about it. Look, the United States, Sudan, all governments, no one does anything for free. The Sudanese are hoping that we will lift longstanding economic sanctions that were imposed during the Clinton administration, and they want to get off the list of state sponsors of terrorism where they've been since 1993. So this is a pragmatic deal for both sides, and the Sudanese want to be rewarded for it.
Ken Silverstein, the intelligence chief, Major General Saleh Abdullah Ghosh, who talks about, boasts about the relationship he has with the CIA. What is his role in the killings in Darfur?
Well, I think maybe your other guest might be able to better address that. I know that the Congressional Research Service has put out a report that lists him as somebody who's directly involved in the counterinsurgency strategy that the Sudanese government has employed in Darfur. I spoke to Sudanese officials who deny that Ghosh or any other senior Sudanese officials are involved in such atrocities. They blame those on militias that they say that they don't exercise control over. So they would say he has no role in the atrocities. I know that there are other observers who have said he has been involved.
Well, Ken Silverstein, we are joined on the phone by Sally Booker, who is the executive director of Africa Action. We'll also be joined by New Jersey Congressmember Donald Payne of New Jersey. But Sally Booker, can you talk about the significance of the information that Ken Silverstein has revealed in the Los Angeles Times of the relationship between the intelligence chief, not only the intelligence chief of Sudan, but the Sudanese government and the United States?
Well, I think it's very significant that it gets a public airing. This growing relationship of cooperation has been a, you know, somewhat of a public secret, if you will, or fairly well known within the foreign policy community, within the Africa advocacy and analyst community. And we have to bear in mind that this is very much like the Cold War, you know, this so-called war on terrorism. The U.S. government has established a hierarchy of U.S. national interests as defined by the administration, the U.S. establishment. And in that hierarchy, essentially African lives are at the bottom, while collecting intelligence, even dubious intelligence, on possible terrorist attacks on American targets is clearly at the top of the hierarchy. So this administration has really wanted to normalize ties with the government in Khartoum since shortly, almost immediately after September 11th. You know, because of bin Laden's presence in Sudan, the Sudanese government felt it always had something to sell to the United States, and that its offers of intelligence cooperation, which go back to the Clinton years, could be a tool they would use to prevent the United States from applying pressure, whether on settling the conflict with southern Sudanese, and now more recently, of course, as a way of sort of shunting pressure aside because of the genocide in Darfur. And the Sudanese government has manipulated this very well.
We're talking to Sally Booker, director of Africa Action, and in Washington in the studio, Ken Silverstein, investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We'll go to break and then come back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Stay with us.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? He'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
See it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Pete Seeger singing, Which Side Are You On? Today, his 86th birthday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are talking about the expose in the Los Angeles Times, Official Pariah Sudan, Valuable to America's War on Terrorism. Despite once harboring bin Laden, Khartoum regime has supplied key intelligence, officials say. And now we're joined by Ken Silverstein in the studio in Washington, Congressmember Donald Payne of New Jersey on the telephone, and Sally Booker, Director of Africa Action. It was a few months after September 11th, 3.5 years ago. The CIA had an active station in Khartoum, according to multiple sources. Among other programs, the agency was running surveillance on suspected foreign extremists with the knowledge and assistance of the Mukhabarat. Material obtained by Sudanese intelligence was turned over to U.S. investigators, and it goes on from there. Ken Silverstein, how did you find out this information?
Well, there have been some allusions to the cooperation previously, and oddly enough, if one goes to the State Department's Patterns of Global Terrorism reports, the last few years, they have referred explicitly to Sudanese cooperation, that they've provided access to individuals. It's been very vague, but it's been stated, and I had seen those references, and I started calling sources and learned that, in fact, the cooperation is pretty extensive, and decided, you know, this is an obvious story. I mean, you know, it's not a surprise if the Jordanians are cooperating with the CIA, or if, you know, the British are cooperating with the CIA, but the fact that Sudan, where bin Laden lived for 5 years and which has a reputation for Islamic radicalism, and which is, as I mentioned, on the list of state sponsors of terror, I mean, that to me is a man-bites-dog story as opposed to the other way around. So it seemed like an obvious story to pursue, and I just started looking into it, working with sources here, and traveled over to Khartoum and was able to interview some fairly senior people in the government there.
Can you talk about the role of U.S. officials, U.S. emissaries for the Bush administration? Who has met with these Sudanese officials?
Well, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Walter Kansteiner, sort of led the opening, even, as I mentioned earlier, pre-9/11, but post-9/11 as well. There was a secret meeting in late September at the American Embassy in London where Kansteiner met with Yahya Hussein Babakar, then the deputy head of the Sudanese intelligence, and there was an agreement struck. I mean, the Bush administration agreed that there would soon be a vote. In fact, the vote took place 3 days later at the UN on whether to lift sanctions against Sudan that had been imposed in 1995 over its role in the an assassination attempt on Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak that took place in Ethiopia in 1995. And the Bush administration abstained on that vote. And by abstaining, the sanctions were lifted. If they had voted no, of course, the sanctions would have remained. And not long afterwards, the Sudanese turned over, you know, significant amount of information, you know, files on Islamic extremists who had been residing in Khartoum in the 1990s and even beyond. So that was really the basis for the... Or the first step, I think. But, you know, clearly other officials in the U.S. government met with the Sudanese. I mean, Yahya Hussein Babakar came here to Washington in January of 2002 and held meetings with senior officials at the CIA. The Sudanese official who handles the liaison relationship with the CIA traveled here late last year and met with CIA officials to discuss Iraq. So there has been extensive consultations between the parties. And in fact, there is now an active CIA station in Khartoum, and there are regular, if not daily, contacts between the two intelligence agencies over there. So, you know, this is an ongoing, regularized channel of communication between the intelligence agencies.
One last thing, Ken Silverstein, before we go to Congressman Donald Payne. Can you describe this secret trip most recently taken and how you got the details of it?
I need to be a little bit careful about that. All I can say is that the CIA sent an executive jet to Khartoum to pick up Major General Ghosh. He was brought over to Washington for 3 days of meetings here. He met with very senior officials in the CIA. And I don't have direct knowledge, of course, of the talks that were held, but clearly he was here to discuss ongoing intelligence collaboration. And I think the trip is especially significant because they've had senior people come over before, but to my knowledge, it's the first time that the head of Sudanese intelligence has come to Washington to meet with top officials there. So I think that sort of speaks for the importance that the CIA gives to the relationship, and it's symbolic of the importance for both sides that the CIA would send a plane over there to bring him here.
New Jersey Congressmember Donald Payne, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here.
Your response to these latest revelations about the relationship, and did you know about it before?
I had some idea that there was contact And as it's been indicated, pretty high-level contact. As we were pushing through our condemnation of the government of Sudan, as you know, the North-South Peace Accord was going on, and a lot of energy. Of course, that was the initial 10-year push to get a peace accord that the U.S. was pretty involved in. As that was sort of coming to fruition, there started to be some additional meetings, high-level meetings, as it's been indicated. I know when when I introduced the resolution on genocide that was passed through the House bipartisan for 22-0, and then went over to the Senate to urge the Senate to do the same thing. It was near the time that we were going on a recess in I think it was July, beyond the last day of our session, when the Senate finally passed it with unanimous consent. While we were doing that, and even after that, I know that there were State Department, at least a State Department official that went over, and from what I understand, really said, even though the Congress is doing that, and Colin Powell came out later, about 2 months later after our resolution passed both houses, with the fact that genocide was occurring, the message was, well, the Congress is annoyed, and we've got some people that are making this a big issue. However, the administration really would like to have some kind of cooperative relationship, and so I was aware of that. Very disturbing, of course, but almost like, you know, don't really pay too much attention to those people in the House and the Senate. We want to have some kind of relationship with you.
So the question is, what are you calling for now? We also tried to reach your senator from New Jersey, John Corzine, senator, Democratic senator. He's in eastern Chad now with Sudanese refugees and then headed to Iraq. He, too, quite angry about this relationship, calling for action on Darfur. Ken Silverstein, you wrote, talked about in your piece what Congress is not getting from the administration in terms of information. For example, getting a list of war criminals, giving a list of those who've committed war crimes in Sudan, but not a roster of government officials who've committed these war crimes.
Well, I know there are a number of steps that, you know, Sudan's critics want taken, and thus far have not been taken by the administration. There is, Congress has issued a list of senior Sudanese officials who they claim have been involved in war crimes. The administration has not released its own list, as Congress has requested that it do. The Congress has requested a number of other steps, targeted sanctions on individuals so that people who are identified as having committed war crimes would have their bank accounts frozen and be barred from international travel. The administration has not done that. There is, in fact, not a arms embargo on the government of Sudan, which critics in Congress have asked for. So there are a whole series of steps that people in Congress want taken that the administration has not taken. I think in terms of whether this is influencing policy, the intelligence cooperation, you know, it's largely a question of, are there steps that could have been taken that haven't been taken? It's not that the administration has taken a lot of active steps, although they did allow the sanctions to come off that were imposed by the UN over the attempt on Mubarak. But it's mostly a question of, you know, from talking to critics of the Sudanese government, they've said this is what we should have done that we haven't done, and they suspect that the intelligence sharing is one reason why the administration hasn't been as aggressive as it might be.
And pressuring the UN Security Council to strengthen the mandate of the African Union Observer mission?
That's another thing. I mean, people have said, look, the UN has been very slow to act, and that's primarily been because of China and Russia, because both of those, especially the Chinese, have extensive economic interest in Sudan. China has a very, very big role in the Sudanese oil industry, and so both of those countries have sought to block action at the UN. Now, critics here have said, we have not really challenged the Chinese or the Russians on that issue, that we should be pressuring them more, and that certainly they have said we should be pressuring the UN to expand the AU mandate. Right now, the AU is there as an observer force, but it's not really authorized to try to prevent human rights abuses from taking place, and people want the UN to expand the AU mandate and to strengthen its mandate. And they, you know, people have called for greater logistical support to the AU mission and greater funding for the AU mission. So, as I said, it's a lot of what people are calling for are steps that they say could have been taken, but thus far the administration has not moved on.
Sally Booker of African Action, what are you demanding right now of Congress, of the Bush administration, of the United Nations?
Well, just to pick up where Ken left off, obviously we're calling for the UN Security Council to establish a Chapter 7 international intervention force. There's a genocide occurring in Darfur. Genocide is a unique crime against humanity. Many people would say it's the ultimate crime. It's the 90th anniversary of the Armenian genocide, 60 years since the Holocaust, 11 years since Rwanda. People keep saying never again. And here we have a genocide unfolding in slow motion since February 2003. 2003 in Darfur. What the Bush administration is doing, it's willing to cover up genocide in favor of an intelligence collaboration with a regime in Sudan. It is defining bilateral relations with countries based on what their governments can do for the U.S. in the so-called war on terrorism. And this is a trade they're perfectly willing to make and to minimize the significance of the atrocities and the crimes against humanity going on in Darfur, even while the administration was forced to acknowledge that, in fact, what's happening there constitutes genocide. It hasn't provided the leadership at all necessary in the UN, and it hasn't challenged China or Russia at all to establish an international force. They've been washing their hands by saying African solutions for African problems, knowing that the African Union doesn't have the capacity, the logistics, the financing, or even the troops to mount the kind of broad multinational intervention necessary to provide protection, you know, to more than 2 million people in a region the size of Iraq. And one thing we haven't mentioned is that as part of the Bush administration's original game plan after September 11th was intelligence cooperation with the Sudanese, who literally called up and said, hey, bin Laden used to live here, come get the files. They want to normalize ties, so they focused on the negotiations between the North and the South, got a peace agreement, which they felt then would allow the U.S. to take Sudan off the terror list, to lift sanctions, and significantly, which would then allow American oil companies to reenter Sudan and to begin to compete with China and the other companies that are there. That was the game plan. The genocide in Darfur has been an inconvenience to that game plan, and they've been forced, largely by public pressure here, to give more attention to and address it, but their leadership has not been, you know, it's not been forthcoming.
Sally Booker, what do you want Congress to do? What are you demanding of Congress members like Donald Payne?
Right. Well, of course, Congressman Payne's been providing great leadership on the House side and broadly in the Congress for years on Sudan, and particularly at the moment, there are bills in both the Senate and the House, the Darfur Accountability Acts, the efforts by members of Congress to actually impose targeted sanctions on the Sudanese government, in addition to those that are already there, to authorize the president and the United States government to use greater options of force in the international force, you know, to bring about change. But it's all that Congress can do is to express its opinion on what the administration ought to be doing and to try and legislate some of these sanctions. It can't force the kind of international cooperation that the administration should be organizing at the UN Security Council. And the other thing is the Bush administration has been opposing this very legislation. They got the Senate to take it out of the supplemental appropriations bill, and they haven't been supportive at all on the House legislation either.
Congressmember Donald Payne, what do you plan to do now with this newly released information and the whole issue of sanctions?
Well, I will certainly raise the issue at our Congressional Black Caucus weekly meeting on Wednesday. I will be meeting with some of our colleagues who've been very supportive, Congressman Wolf, Congressman Tancredo, Congressman Cummings, we will try to come up with some strategy, as Sally Booker said. We have come out strong. You know, it was 3 months after we declared genocide in the House and the Senate that the administration declared that genocide was going on. I listed 51, read them from the well of the House, 51 Sudanese persons, government officials, starting with the Vice President Taha, who allegedly is the one who orchestrated the release of the Janjaweed, supporting them financially, equipping them. And so he was the chief negotiator of the North-South Accord. He is alleged by Darfurians there and here as the one who is the mastermind. Now, how do you negotiate with him in good faith? What the U.S. government did a decade ago, the CIA, in their wisdom, removed practically every single CIA station in Africa, just eliminated 10, 12 years ago as they were cutting back. Therefore, once again, mismanaging an agency had now to rely on government officials, where if they had kept their kind of communications that they do, allegedly, I don't know how they actually operate, but they have operatives on the ground. By removing them from Africa, now they have to depend on the government of Sudan. Also, as it's been mentioned by Sally Booker, we put pressure on Talisman, which was a Canadian company, to withdraw its activities in Sudan. The PetroChina and Malaysians went in bigger force. We have got to put some pressure on China. However, I believe, as Sally said, that once you can get sanctions removed, then U.S. companies could go in. There's still a lot of untapped oil resources in Sudan, and that's a part of this agenda of trying to normalize relations with Sudan so that U.S. oil companies can go in and start exploring oil. And so we are going to have certainly a dialogue with the supporters of Sudan when I get back to Washington this afternoon, and try once again. We had capital market sanctions in our legislation. Congressman Tancredo and Bacchus from Alabama, and it was removed. Greenspan came and said capital markets must be removed. And as it's been mentioned, Senator Frist was denied a visa. Now, here's a person who perhaps may run for president of the United States. How can you have normal relations or even have conversation with a government that said that your president, your Senate leader, is not welcome in our country? He's not thought of enough. Senator Corzine, I believe, also put an application. I have never applied to the government of Khartoum because it's an illegitimate government. I don't recognize them. And what they do is to wait you out, tell you we'll get back to you, and then decide if they will let you come in, then take you where they want you to go and tell you when you should leave.
Well, on that note, Congressmember Donald Payne, I want to thank you very much for being with us, as well as Sally Booker of Africa Action and Ken Silverstein of the Los Angeles Times. We will link to the Los Angeles Times expose at our website, democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go from the dawn of the nuclear age 60 years ago to the end of the Vietnam War 30 years ago. We'll speak with whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. Stay with us.
Funky, down, nasty.
Hey, listen to the man.
Well, Godfather.
Hey, back.
Cold-blooded. People, people, gotta get over before we go under. Down. People, people, we gotta get over before we go under. Hey, country, you didn't say what you meant. You just changed a brand new funky president.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, and that is Funky President by James Brown, who turns 72 today. I'm Amy Goodman. By the way, other news from Africa. 7 people have died in Somalia after an explosion in Mogadishu. The explosion occurred as Somalia's newly appointed prime minister, Ali Mohamed Gedi, was visiting Mogadishu for the first time as prime minister. Gedi's transitional government is currently based in Nairobi in neighboring Kenya. Again, that news, 7 people have died in an explosion in Mogadishu. As we turn now to the anniversaries. A representative from nearly all governments of the world convened at the United Nations on Monday for the start of a month-long conference to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's been 60 years since the dawn of the nuclear age, 30 years since the end of the Vietnam War. April 30th, 1975, North Vietnamese tanks rolled through the gates of the presidential palace in Saigon, marking the end of the Vietnam War. Today, we're joined by a man who helped end that war, Daniel Ellsberg, once described by Henry Kissinger as the world's most dangerous man. During the Cold War, Daniel Ellsberg was a U.S. Marine Company commander, a Pentagon official, and analyst at the Rand Corporation. In October 69, he began smuggling out of his office and Xeroxing the 7,000-page top-secret study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, known as the Pentagon Papers. He did so with the intent of revealing these secrets to Congress and the American public, and in so doing, he set in motion actions that would eventually topple the Nixon presidency and end the Vietnam War. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. So how do you relate Vietnam, the secrets, and anti-nuclear activism today? What's going on at the United Nations, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? You sort of link them all as you take those
really
as your
are,
mission.
There's a number of causes in the world that justify an individual or a group of people committing their lives to change the world, to change the situation. I think there's Vietnam, ending the war in Vietnam was one of those. Ending the nuclear arms race, ending the threat of nuclear war is certainly another. There's a man I'm sure we'll be discussing, Mordecai Vanunu in Israel, who spent 18 years in prison for revealing that Israel was a nuclear state. In doing so, he hoped to change the understanding of our nuclear dangers in the world and to change that status for Israel. That was worth his life, he figured, and he hasn't regretted it. I faced 115 years in prison for trying to end the Vietnam War with a revelation of truth. I didn't have to spend that because the crimes of the government against me were revealed in time. So unlike Vanunu, I didn't spend 11 and a half years in solitary, which he did. And yet, I would have been willing to do that, just as Vanunu regrets nothing now.
Now, you recently went to Israel.
Originally, no.
Recently,
just a month ago, hoping to speak for Vanunu at a meeting of the Knesset, hearing his restrictions, which were laid on him after he got out of 18 years in prison. He was told that he couldn't talk to foreigners like me or you, couldn't talk to foreign journalists like you, on pain of going back to prison. And he went ahead and did that. He exercised his human rights to speak freely. And as a result, he's been newly indicted on the day that I left. The Knesset hearing was canceled, and we realized why the day after when he was indicted, just for talking to people like us. And he's continuing to do that. He spoke just yesterday via the telephone and tape to a meeting here in New York.
We want to play an excerpt of the tape that was sent from Israel. This is Mordechai Vanunu.
Now, in this year 2005, in United Nations NPT Treaty, I'm asking you again, if you are really want to make the Middle East free from nuclear weapons, it is here Israel have the nuclear weapons, not Iraq, not Iran. Here, with all the proofs in your hand, so time come for you to make a decision demanding from Israel to open the mononuclear reactor for inspection and to sign the NPT treaty. Also, you also can remember that this reactor, the mono reactor, working beyond its time. It was built to work for 25 years to 30 years, but this reactor now working more than 40 years. There is no justification for any state to have nuclear weapons. There is no justification to use atomic bomb.
That is Mordechai Vanunu speaking in Israel. Where is he now? I understand that the latest...
He's where that clip shows him, at St. George Cathedral, where he rings the bells, by the way, for the cathedral at noon every day over Jerusalem. I went up and helped him one day. Neither of us like the word whistleblower too much. Bell ringer is one that I like. I was happy to be able to do that with Mordechai. But he's likely to go back to prison just for saying things. This may be a new count in his indictment, the clip that you just showed. He won't stop talking about the need for a nuclear-free world.
I understand Democracy Now! Was named in the indictment.
That's right. You were named personally in it as having spoken to him, along with a lot of others, who he was charged with speaking to 25 interviews, and he said at his indictment hearing, no, it was over 51.
What about this issue of the Dimona nuclear plant that he raises, of it operation beyond its time?
An aspect of Israel's policy of, quote, ambiguity, that's his simply denying or not acknowledging that it's a nuclear state, which the United States has known, by the way, since 1970 when it was announced. They knew it long before that, but it was announced in 1970 that we knew Israel was a nuclear state. But an aspect then of their continuing this hoax of pretending that... they're not, is that they can't, the citizens of Israel can't address or investigate at all the safety conditions of Dimona, where they make the nuclear weapons, and which, as usual, as at Hanford and other places in this country, as at the test site, there are, of course, radiation accidents. People have died from radiation there, as at most such places, and it represents a particular danger because it's been used so long.
Why focus on Israel when we're talking about North Korea that just sent a missile into the Bay of Japan, of course, Iran, the whole issue of the nuclear politics around Iran?
Well, actually, Israel has no less right or more right to have nuclear weapons than the other nuclear states, and that is to say, essentially, from a human point of view, zero. But to single them out doesn't make a lot of sense, except that, of course, as the nuclear monopoly in the Middle East, they're a constant provocation to other countries in the Middle East for proliferation, but also is revealing the hypocrisy of the U.S. stance from the very beginning. The U.S. has pretended from the start of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was first signed in 68 and ratified in 70, just 35 years ago, has pretended that its U.S. policy to oppose all proliferation beyond the five nuclear states named there. In fact, that has always been a fraud, and the countries of the world have essentially known that. Israel, with our toleration, if not encouragement, was a nuclear state at the point that treaty was signed, 1968 and 1970, and we knew that. That was the fraud that Mordechai Vanunu exposed. But the effect of the world knowing that the U.S. position that we opposed all proliferation was false is that there's no possibility of non-proliferation being a real norm. The United States, the world's richest power, has made it clear that we're quite in favor of proliferation to our friends, if you're friendly with us. Iran, under the Shah, got our not only toleration but encouragement for the nuclear activities we're now denouncing. Iraq, where we just went to war to prevent them from getting WMDs, was encouraged and helped in its nuclear program while it was fighting Iran, and so forth. India, Pakistan have all benefited from U.S. toleration or encouragement. So we don't have a non-proliferation policy. If that's to happen, our policy will have to change, and above all, it will have to change in favor of our, at last, taking account of our commitment under Article 6 to move toward disarmament. No American president has had any intention of carrying out the supposedly solemn commitment under Article 6 to undertake negotiations toward total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Daniel Ellsberg, you have often credited anti-war protesters with turning you around, looking out the window of the Pentagon and seeing them outside. I wanted to turn now to a group of students who are currently occupying the University of Hawaii Administration Building to protest the building of a military research center on their campus. This is the same campus where the deadly chemical Agent Orange was developed in the 1960s using classified military research similar to what's being proposed. We are joined on the phone now by Ikaika Hussey, one of the students who is currently occupying at University of Hawaii. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Aloha.
Can you talk about what you're doing right now as Daniel Ellsberg is listening in?
Well, right now, actually, we're all sleeping, except for me. But we're engaged in a civil disobedience action. We've occupied Bachman Hall, which we've called Bachman Hall Demilitarized Zone, for the last 5 days. And we will continue to do so until the administration decides to stop the creation of this classified military research center.
And what exactly would this do, and the history of the Agent Orange on your campus?
Well, Agent Orange is a real blight on the history of our university and on Hawaii. It led to, you know, untold destruction in Southeast Asia, and also, of course, the U.S. veterans who have been affected by it. And also, even here in Hawaii, there are areas which are still defoliated and contaminated by Agent Orange. There are also researchers involved in the creation of Agent Orange who they're just employees of the state university. They didn't know what they were being exposed to, and they have since died from exposure to Agent Orange. And so it's a real a sore point in the history of the University of Hawaii, and it's something that we keep in mind when the university talks about more military research.
And the building of the Navy Military Research Center, what would it do on campus?
It would be tied into the existing large military infrastructure in Hawaii. Hawaii is one of the most militarized places in the United States, and it has been since the invasion of Hawaii by U.S. military forces in 1893. Right now, the island of Oahu, which is the most urban island, it's 25% controlled by the military. There's about 20% of all of Hawaii, all the eight major islands, which is controlled by the military. And what happened with this military research facility is it would tie into the existing military installations and also civilian installations, which would then be able to be used for classified purposes. From all the points in the island chain, it would tie into Star Wars ballistic missile defense work that's being done here at the Pacific Missile Range facility. It would tie into underwater kind of work with sea mines and so forth. And most importantly, it would make Hawaii a part of the American war machine, which is not something that we want.
Daniel Ellsberg, as you listen to this political science graduate student at the University of Hawaii occupying the administration offices, your final comment from your history.
Well, everyone has to sleep regularly, and I'm glad that those students are sleeping where they are, obstructing by their bodies a process that shouldn't be going on at all. I don't think we'll ever be out of Iraq. We will not avoid the war in Iran. We will not change our relation to dictatorial, tyrannous governments as in the Sudan without the kinds of opposition that we saw in the Vietnam War, against the Vietnam War, conscientious, truthful, nonviolent civil disobedience. And that is more than symbolic, people actually showing that they're willing to do everything they can nonviolently and truthfully to bring these processes to the attention of the fellow voters, but also to stop them, to obstruct them. And that can have a great personal cost, as Mordecai Vanunu found, has suffered, and it can be very worthwhile. It can save very many lives. So I want to say my appreciation to the people in Hawaii and hope that they'll inspire much similar activity over here.
Daniel Ellsberg, I want to thank you for being with us, as well as Ikaika Hussey speaking to us from the University of Hawaii. And shout out to our listeners and viewers in Hawaii. Democracy Now! Airs in Hawaii on KKCR Community Radio and community TV stations Kaku and Olelo. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up, a very special thank you to the set designers who have helped design our new set here at Democracy Now! Now, Ben Baraud, and Anu Schwartz. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.